Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. New York Times bestselling author Michael Fleeman strips away the pleasant veneer of the Silver Lakes neighborhood in California to tell a shocking story about a headline-grabbing crime. Sabrina Limon, a vivacious blonde mother of two and part-time sample girl at Costco, is handing out free food samples one day when in walks handsome young firefighter Jonathan Hearn, shopping for the station. Their conversation leads to a flirtation that leads to a steamy affair that has them hooking up once and twice a week at her home, his home, and out in hidden spots in the vast Mojave. Sabrina finds in Jonathan's embrace the love and understanding she lacks at home. To the outside world, husband Robert is a big, tattooed teddy bear of a man, a hard-working railroad mechanic, loved by all. This gregarious couple seemed matched by their love of family, friends, and good times. But the partying had gotten out of control for Sabrina. There was boozing and wife-swapping and group sex. Once a turn-on, it now left Sabrina feeling debased, dehumanized, spiritually adrift. Robert won't talk about it, consumed by his work, boat, truck, and social life. With Jonathan showering Sabrina with poetry, gifts, religious insights, and, of course, illicit sex, a devious plan is hatched one August night. Robert Limon is found dead of two gunshots in a pool of blood. False leads send police into dead ends until a tip arrives from a most unexpected place. For Sabrina, it's a stunning betrayal that hurdles the case back to a perfect little place in the desert. With informants, undercover cops, and wiretaps, investigators discover a romance fueled by lies and dangerous fantasies. But are Sabrina and Jonathan merely covering up an affair, or are they hiding a conspiracy that led to murder? The book that we're featuring this evening is Better Off Dead, a sordid true story of sex, sin, and murder, with my special guest, journalist and author, Michael Fleeman. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Michael Fleeman.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Very fascinating story, and enjoyed this book immensely. Let's start with how you came to want to write about this particular case. How did you come to be in a position to write this book, Better Off Dead?
Well, this was a story that took place on the fringes of the Los Angeles suburban area, and when Robert Limon was murdered in Tehachapi, California, it made the local news down here. I'm in Los Angeles, and I followed it off and on, and it began as one of those tragic stories, whodunit, why would this very nice man with a loving wife and a good family be murdered? And as developments arrived, it became clear that there was much, much more going on behind the scenes. And I'm always fascinated by stories about places we think we know, you know, the nice little neighborhoods and the charming communities and the happy families. And when you sort of peel back those layers, you find all kinds of secrets. And in this case, it all added up to murder.
Now, you start this story at Tehachapi, California, and a man named Sean Ware on Sunday, August 7, 2014, he rides for an overnight shift. These are 12-hour shifts, and he senses something's wrong right away. Can you tell us, set the stage of what happens that day on August 17th, and what does he discover and set this story in motion?
Sean is a mechanic for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, and his place of work is a workshop in Tehachapi, which is in the high desert, Southern California, about an hour outside of Bakersfield on the way to the little town of Mojave. It's a very busy stretch of track. Trains that come from the east, this is their sort of last stretch before they end up in the west and in Bakersfield. And Sean is arriving for his overnight shift, and he's what they call a rapid responder. When a train breaks down, he gets in his truck and he goes out and fixes it. And he is relieving the day shift guy, who is Robert Lamone. And when Sean arrives at the workshop, he sees Robert's truck there. He sees that little office has been ransacked. And as he looks on the other side of the truck, he sees Robert lying there dead. And it looks like there's a wound to his head. And, of course, Sean is horrified and terrified, and he calls 911.
Now, you say he calls 911, and they tell him to maybe – he doesn't sure if he's dead or not, so they say maybe try some CPR, and then they tell him to get out of the building. So now, So now the police arrive. What – you talk about Kern County Senior Department – Deputy Marcus Moncur arrives first. What do they find in their cursory investigation right at the garage? What can they deduce immediately or not deduce?
They look inside the garage, and they see some of the same stuff that Sean Ware saw, the co-worker saw. They see this little office has been ransacked, it looks like. Somebody's gone through the drawers. A computer is missing. They then see the body on the ground. It's lying next to the front wheel of the work truck. They see some kind of a wound to the head. It could be a gunshot. It could be a blow to the head. As they search more, they see some footprints behind the building in the dirt. And as they get a search warrant and look inside the garage, they find a bullet shell, slug, that looks like it had hit the ceiling lamp and then fallen down onto the ground. And finally, they find some blood under the body, and they find some blood spatter behind the body on a little refrigerator.
Now, you talk about a Detective Meyer introduced this central figure in this book from Bakersfield, from Detective Meyer. But you also say that they look at this, what looks like a burglary, with some suspicion, don't they?
Yeah, one of the other cops who arrived is a veteran robbery detective. And it appeared to him that the ransacking of the office was staged. He had no real evidence of that, only just kind of a gut feeling. Just looked kind of haphazard. It looked like they were trying to make it, they or the singular person was trying to make it look like a burglary that ended a murder, and he had his suspicions right off the bat.
Now, when they talk to Sean Ware, they're just getting a sort of an indication because they know this is the crime scene and it's a workplace, and they ask them that if Robert usually worked in Tehachapi, and so he tells them that not necessarily. So how do they get around to, in short order, finding out who he is and where his wife is and speaking to her? So what's the process that they go after speaking to Sean and gaining just some basic information about Robert's whereabouts likely and why? Tell us how they proceed.
Sure. Sean has a little bit of information. Robert actually is not the normal day shift guy there. He was filling in for somebody else. And he normally worked 2 hours away in a town called Barstow. And so it was sort of a last minute thing that he was even there, which is the first sort of twist. If Robert was targeted in this, you know, it had to be somebody who knew his schedule because he wasn't normally there, or if it was random, it would have been random. You know, Sean tells them what little he knows. They're not close friends, but he tells them, you know, he's a nice guy. Everybody likes Robert. He has no drug problem that he knew of, no financial problems, and seemed very happily married and had a couple of kids. So they get this sort of brief background on Robert. They also find his cell phone in the office, and on the cell phone are these frantic text messages from his wife. You know, when are you coming home? We're worried about you. And that's how they ultimately are able to find his wife.
Now, there's Sabrina, Robert's wife, and her sister. So how does Sabrina find out about this? And when do police first talk to her, and what is her reaction? Tell us about that.
Well, Sabrina is at home. Now, Robert lives, about a two-hour drive away from the crime scene. You know, part of this book is having to understand the vast nature of the landscape here. This is all one county, Kern County, but it's about the size of Connecticut. You know, it's
right.
A big, wide open space, and there's not much in between things. So Robert, he drove a couple of hours to get there. He lives in a high desert town called Silver Lakes. The development. And it's about 2 hours north of Los Angeles. And so Sabrina is at home. This was a Sunday. She's getting her kids ready. They have two young kids, a son and a daughter, and she's getting them ready for school the next day. They go to church. And near the end of the day, she's calling and texting Robert. She talked to him briefly that day when he was out on a call fixing a train. And you know, then he didn't call back, and normally he calls from the road on his way home, and she started texting and saying, you know, we're worried about you, and, you know, she's becoming increasingly frantic, according to her family. Friends come over, sister comes over to the house to kind of comfort her. She tries to put the kids to bed, but, that doesn't work, and finally some people from the railroad, a couple of supervisors from the railroad come by. And they're the ones who inform her that her husband is dead. And they don't tell her what the cause is. She gets the impression it's an accident, some kind of a horrible accident. But she's really left in the dark. And it's not until about 1 o'clock in the morning, this all happened around 5, 6, 7, 1 o'clock in the morning, that the coroner calls her and says, yeah, your husband's been killed. And then shortly, in fact, she's literally on the phone with the coroner when the detective, Detective Meyer, calls her. And he tells her he's a homicide detective and starts asking her pointed questions. And that's when she finds out that it appears her husband's been murdered.
What was her demeanor as reported by Detective Meyer in response to that news?
Well, Meyer actually recorded the phone call, so we could all hear her demeanor. And she sounded tired and confused and frantic. She was trying to answer the detective's questions. There seemed to be a lot going on at the house in the background. You know, she kept saying, what happened? What happened to my husband? So her reaction, to my mind and definitely to Detective Myers, was very appropriate.
Now, the railroad is basically quite good, and there's an insurance policy, but how do police respond to this crime? And obviously, they know they have to speak to the people involved, so when do police first speak with Sabrina?
Well, they talk to Detective Meyer talks to her on the phone that night at 1 o'clock in the morning. It's a very short phone call, about 15 minutes. And, you know, they just get the basic information about his schedule, the sort of the things we just went over. You know, was that his normal schedule? Where was he normally based? Meyer asks, you know, one of these awkward routine questions, but, you know, do you have any problems in your marriage? And She says, no, no, no. Does he have any enemies? No. Everybody loved Robert. It was a brief conversation, and you know, Meyer just said, okay, here's my number. Call me. You know, we'll hook up later at a better time and do this in person. Meanwhile, police look into Robert's background. They look into his schedule. They talk to his, you know, a number of his coworkers, and they're trying to find out. It doesn't look like, aside from a laptop being missing, anything much has been stolen. There's not much there anyway. There's these big wrenches and things they use to fix trains, but no money is missing. There would be no money there to be missing. And all the friends and coworkers of Robert, to a man, describe him as a very, very nice, friendly guy. You know, always a smile on his face, happy at work, happy in his marriage, and they're really perplexed as to what happened. The railroad also has its own little police department, and they are conducting an investigation in coordination with the sheriff's department. And Robert not only had life insurance, but you know, there's $1 million to $2 million settlement that is likely in the event that the railroad is somehow at fault in his death. So they take this very seriously, and they issue a big reward, you know, for any information leading to why he was killed. But you know, the early part of the investigation turns up a lot of zeros, until they go into the office of the manager of the industrial park where this workshop is based, and they ask him, you know, do you have any security footage around the grounds? And they say yes, and they review that security footage, and they get their first little lead in the case.
Now, what is that first lead that they get? What do they see? What can they deduce from there? And how do they go from that image that they get from one of the surveillance cameras?
So it's a camera. There's cameras all over the facility, but this one's posted right near the entrance, and it's in the direction of where this workshop is, which is near the back of the facility. And what they see at about 5 o'clock. PM, which is, you know, roughly the time that Robert might have been killed. Sean Ware arrives, you know, about 6:30, quarter of seven. They see a person walking with a limp, kind of in the direction of the murder scene. It's grainy. The person is far away, looks kind of bulky, probably is a man. But they see this person walking in the direction of the workshop. And this gives police and the railroad something they can release to the public, which they do very quickly the next couple of days. They release this footage of this limping person who is their person of interest.
You also talk about a secret witness program where anonymous tip line, and they're waiting for leads as well. And then you talk about the Dr. Robert Whitmore, the forensic pathologist, and his deductions after his examination.
What they find is as they're getting tips from the release of this video, they conduct the autopsy, Dr. Whitmore. And it's a rather unusual unusual findings. He confirms that Robert Lamone was shot to death, large caliber, like 44, 45. The bullets traveled in kind of an upward trajectory, almost like the person was on the ground shooting up toward Robert. He was kind of the bullets traveled through different parts of his body, ended up in his brain, and they were able to take the slug out. But both of the shots would have been fatal. And they were shot at very, very close range, maybe even point blank. So, you know, this tells the police that perhaps the killer is somebody Robert knew, or somebody he allowed to get close to him, or the killer somehow snuck up by crawling and then shot upwards. But the going theory is that this might be somebody he knew or suspected he knew, and you combine that with the fact that the killer, if Robert himself was targeted, had to have known his schedule, suggests that this might be somebody with a personal motive to kill Robert. And so that's what they glean from the autopsy.
Now, you talk about Detective Myers arrives from Bakersfield, 125 miles away to Silver Lakes, this little suburb, little community. And there are 30 people at this home. So tell us what he encounters and experiences with 30 people, friends and relatives, gathered around Sabrina at the home.
Sure. This is about 3 or 4 days after the murder. And he had done the quickie phone interview. And Meyer and his partner now are going to do an in-person interview with Sabrina. And the county seat of Kern County is in Bakersfield, and the Silver Lakes is way across the desert. You have to go up a mountain and down a mountain and all the way across near the Air Force Base where the space shuttle land. I mean, this is like way out in the middle of nowhere, and he's driving for hours. And they come across Silver Lakes. Now, this is a very unusual community in Southern California. You know, once you get out of L.A. And you're headed toward Las Vegas, it's all desert. And if you turn off the freeway and you go 30 or 40 miles off the freeway on the way to Las Vegas, you end up in this town of Silver Lakes. And it's as if somebody had plopped a little planned community in the middle of the desert. It's this charming little neighborhood, family neighborhood. There's a golf course. There's two lakes, and people go boating, and there's good schools and, you know, a little shopping village. And it's kind of a surreal scene, this development. And Meyer and his partner drive up to the Lamone house. It's a very nice house. Again, it's near a golf course. It's near the lake. It's across the street from the elementary school, and they get there, and the house is just full of people, and these are friends and family, and they're all there presumably to support Sabrina during this difficult time. And so Meyer's handing out business cards, and no one seems to know anything other than Robert's a nice guy, and they're very happily married, and they go off into a quieter bedroom. And this is when the first sort of real interview takes place.
She is asked about the marriage. She's asked about infidelity. But she talks about, maybe even lets it slip, about talking about partying. And then he notes her demeanor and makes a conclusion. Tell us about some of these questions and what he concludes afterwards.
Right. Well, the questions become more pointed now. You know, it's been a few days. The shock, while still real, is not immediate. And it's just routine questioning. And I asked Meyer, I said, you know, why did you ask these questions? He said, well, we ask everybody what's going on. And if a husband dies, they ask the wife, you know, are there any problems in the relationship? And she said, no, we have a very happy, happy marriage. You know, any infidelity? And she said, no, nothing that I know about. And then she kind of backpedals a little bit. She said, but, you know, we do like to party. You know, we like to have a good time. You know, we like to have a few drinks and make some noise. You know, the Silver Lakes is a resort kind of community. There's a lake with powerboats on it, and there's golf, and, you know, it's a fun place to live. And so, you know, Meyer is a little not suspicious, but he's taking note. It was the first sort of crack in the demeanor, and then, excuse me, then Meyer throws her a curve. Sorry, I spent the week in Las Vegas, and I came back with a flu. Then he throws her a curve. He tells her, "Well, you know, we looked at your husband's phone." and we found topless photos of women. Can you please explain that to us? And she is shocked. She is stunned, and she's obviously very, very upset. And she says, well, maybe some of them are me. Maybe some of them are friends. And that's when she talks again about the parting and about how they have such a good time. And, you know, Meyer's leaving this interview thinking, okay, maybe not everything is perfect, as all the coworkers have said, in this relationship. Maybe there's some room here to explore deeper in their relationship.
He also notes that she talks about, he asked her if it was an open relationship, and he asked if there was any jealousy. And so to those questions, she responded seemingly sort of appropriately, right? With no flag.
Yeah, no. You know, they see these naked pictures, and you have to understand, and this is what, you know, again, we could hear the conversation. He recorded the conversation, and Meyer's almost embarrassed to be asking these questions. His partner is embarrassed to be asking these questions.
Right.
A lot of guys, even nice guys, have been known to go on the internet and download some stuff they shouldn't be downloading, and maybe that's what ended up on his phone. You know, they just had to ask. And they had to ask, you know, do you have an open marriage? Because if they did, that would inject a new motive into all this, which is a jealous husband.
Right. Now, you say August 18th, there's a gunsmith in Tehachapi, and he calls police a little bit after this August 18th to report what he experienced. We got to remember that we haven't mentioned that the slug, it seems, was a 45. It seemed to be a 45 caliber handgun ammunition from there. So tell us about the gunsmith in Tehachapi and what he says to police and what
just as Meyer, literally, as he's driving away from Silver Lakes after talking to Sabrina, and he's had these suspicions about her, kind of worried, you know, thinking I got to circle back on this relationship. He gets a call in the car, and this gunsmith has emerged. And the gunsmith, who lives and works not far from the crime scene, says that somebody had come into his shop right after the murder and dropped off a big caliber handgun and said, I need the firing pin replaced. And the gunsmith thought that was kind of odd because he looked at it and the firing pin seemed fine. And, you know, then he starts talking to this customer. Well, it turns out the customer works in the same complex that Robert was killed. And so, you know, Meyer is really elated at this point. Police are, okay, we've found the murder weapon. This is their first big break, and he almost forgets about everything that Sabrina said about topless photos and partying and all that.
Now, how do they proceed with this to realize that this is not their man?
Well, they interview the gunsmith. They get the story that I just went over, and he's kept the gun, and they seize the gun, and they run a background check on the customer. They have the customer's name. And it turns out the customer has a son who has an arrest warrant out for him, felony arrest warrant. And so they're pretty convinced they've got their guy. So they bring the gun back to the lab to run a ballistics check. And that's where they fire a bullet out of the gunsmith gun and match it to the bullet that was taken out of Robert's body. And unfortunately, they did not match. That was not the gun used to kill Robert Lamone.
The other thing that led them to believe that they might have their man was that this man had a limp, and then they find another man that has a limp,
exactly.
And then they go back. Tell us about interesting
dead ends. The gunsmith guy, the customer, had a limp, and you know he didn't quite match the little bigger than the guy in the video, but you know, he still had a limp. And then they find another person who was spotted walking across a field toward the crime scene right around the time of the murder, who also had a limp. And he was kind of a local guy who had some problems, looked like he'd been drinking a little bit. But once they interviewed him, and they're thinking to themselves, you know, what are the odds? We have two people now with limps and a guy in the video with a limp. They start interviewing him. They realize that, you know, he had been injured in a car accident, and he was actually in the hospital at the time all this was going on. So he couldn't have been it. So their two really good leads evaporate within days of each other, and now they're back at square one.
Now, you talk about then, literally almost right after this, Meyer gets a call again. Detective Meyer gets a call from someone he had passed his card to at Sabrina's that day where the 30 people were there. And so tell us who he gets a call from, and what does that detective hear from him?
Yeah, so, you know, just by routine, he handed out all his business cards. He didn't even know who all those people were. And one of them, his name is Jason Bernatine. And Jason is the best friend of Robert Lamone. And his wife, Kelly, is the best friend of Sabrina Lamone. These are the closest people to the Lamones. And Jason has a story to tell. He says that they suspected, the Bernatine suspected, that, a year or so earlier, Sabrina was having an inappropriate relationship with a younger man she had met at work. Now, Sabrina worked at Costco, as you had mentioned. She's one of those ladies who hands out the free food samples. And one day this guy, his name is Jonathan Hearn, had come into the Costco to get supplies. Now, Jonathan worked as a fireman, just like Jason did. Gets a little confusing, but the two of them kind of knew each other through fire department circles. They work at different departments, different station houses. But Robert's best friend, Jason, sort of knew who this Jonathan was. And it seemed like this Jonathan guy was paying a little too much attention to the married Sabrina Lamone that was appropriate. And several months after they had met at the Costco, this Jonathan shows up at a restaurant where Robert and Sabrina and Kelly and Jason, all their friends, were having a big party. It was a March Madness around the college football playoff. And you know, this Jonathan guy just shows up, and, you know, he wraps his arm around Sabrina, and they pose for a photo, and it just seemed a little fishy. But then, you know, Sabrina was a very, very gregarious woman. She was very friendly. She was a hugger and a kisser, and, you know, they didn't make too much of this. But this is all stuff that Jason is telling the detective, and Jason then relates that not long after that, Jason is working on his house with Robert one day, and Jason gets a phone call. And it's Jonathan Hearn, and he wants to talk to Robert. And Jason's like, what the heck? Why are you, what's going on here? Well, Robert just happened to be there. He hands the phone to Robert. And Robert Lamone and this young Jonathan Hearn, he's about 20 years old, have a very intense phone conversation. Jason can't hear what's going on, but you know, it doesn't look good. And then Robert hands the phone back to Jason, and Jason's like, man, what was up with that? And he said, look, it's taken care of. It's over. It turns out that Robert had seen some text messages on Sabrina's phone from this Jonathan, and they had gotten into a big fight, and Jonathan had called to apologize. Apparently these text messages were, you're beautiful, and you're wonderful, and Robert and his wife got into a horrible argument, and she promised, that there was nothing going on. He was just a close friend, and I won't talk to him again. And this Jonathan claims he was reaching out to apologize to Robert for sending these text messages. And So, you know, time had passed, and Jason and Robert and Sabrina and Kelly and that whole group there in Silver Lakes, they sort of forgot about Jonathan Hearn. He faded into the distance, and whatever was going on between Sabrina and Jonathan appeared to be over. And then after Robert's murder, Jonathan calls Jason again. And this time, it's another long, weird, rambling apology. He'd heard about the murder, and he just felt so badly about that time he had sent those text messages and was paying too close attention and to Sabrina, and just forgive me. And, you know, Jason just thought it was so strange, and the conversation was so weird, that he had to tell the police detective about it. He said, I don't think there's anything here. I don't think Jonathan's this nice guy. I can't imagine he'd be involved. And I know Sabrina's not involved, but I can't let it go. And he passes on this whole strange story to the detective.
Now, you say that Jason told he told everything about this meeting. Did he also tell him about what they saw in 2014 after they thought that this whole thing had died down? Well, Kelly one day walks into Costco Pharmacy.
Yeah, so after they talk to the detective sort of deputizes Jason and Kelly and makes them unofficial investigators. And he says, you know, why don't you keep an eye on Sabrina? You know, just let's see what's going on with her. This is after the murder. Now, keep in mind, Kelly is Sabrina's best friend, her hairdresser, their confidants, their kids play together, they travel together, you know, birthdays and Christmas and dress-up parties or Halloween. I mean, she's very, very close to Sabrina. But at the same time, Sabrina's been acting a little strange after the murder, and not just because her husband's been murdered. And so at Meyer's insistence, Kelly and Jason kind of keep their eye on Sabrina. Now, Sabrina just lives down the street. They all sort of work in the same area. And one day they go, and Jason and Kelly go to Costco where Sabrina works. And Jason has an injury. He says, Kelly, you go in. He had to pick up some medication. And Kelly goes into the Costco, and who does she see but Sabrina, her best friend, and Jonathan Hearn, the two of them together walking down an aisle in the store. And, you know, she's just stunned. This is not long after Robert's murder. What's she doing with this guy again? It just really upsets her. She pays for her purchase, and she runs out of there, and she's just really mad and upset. And they relate this to Detective Meyer.
Now, what she also does is happens to go by the neighborhood, especially after this, spots certain vehicles. First, it's a truck. Tell us what she does, what she sees, and then what she sees the next day, and in her, I guess, as being enlisted unofficially to help the police, what does she see and what does she report?
Yeah, so Kelly is sort of accidentally on purpose swinging by Sabrina's house. Again, they live just down the street from each other. And she sees a motorcycle. It's kind of a vintage-looking motorcycle parked at the house one day. And then another day she sees a truck, big diesel truck, parked in the driveway, which is not unusual. This is people in this area drive trucks. But then she sees the truck there the next morning. So whoever was driving that truck had spent the night, it appears. And Kelly says to Sabrina, whose truck was that? And she gives the name of some guy, a friend of theirs they used to know. Oh, it's just a friend of mine. And Kelly does not believe Sabrina. She is really starting to suspect that Sabrina is hiding something, you know, between the Jonathan sighting at Costco and this truck, and it's like, who's this motorcycle? And then one day, and keep in mind, there's only one little road in and one little road out of Silver Lakes, and you know, it's either Kelly or Jason see that same truck, and they could swear that Jonathan was driving that truck. So now Jason and Kelly formerly best friends of Sabrina Lamone are really starting to suspect that maybe she has something, or at least knows something, about her husband's murder. Keep in mind, there are no other leads. Police have gotten nowhere in this case.
You also talk about something that's amazing as well, very visual. Jason runs into Sabrina and the children, and after a short bit of conversation, what do the children say to Jason? What do they mention?
They mention their friend Jonathan. And
yeah.
The children know who Jonathan is. And now Jason's got just shivers. It's like, wait a second. Could this be more than Sabrina just running into Jonathan at Costco? Is he now part of their lives?
Now, you talk about Kelly is now active or proactive, and she and Sabrina go for a walk. This is in September, near the end of September. They're confidants, like you say, but does the conversation ever come around to anything other than Robert and any mention of Jonathan whatsoever?
Yeah, I mean, Kelly asks her about it and actually asks Sabrina a couple of times and says, you know, what's going on here? And Sabrina's demeanor is defensive, and she's like, look, you know, you can't tell me, you know, you can't tell this guy who he can see and who he can't see, and basically, you know, butt out of my business. And this is stunning to Kelly. They'd always been close. They'd always confided. They'd always trusted each other, and Sabrina's given her the brush off.
Now, Meyer does his due diligence, and he shows up at the Bernatines with Detective Kimmel. And what information does he get from extensive questioning of these people?
Yeah, well, they get the stuff that I had gone over before. They get a more detailed picture of Jonathan Hearn apparently trying to first meeting Sabrina many months earlier, showing up at this gathering at the restaurant, trying to implicate himself into their social circle. You know, say, hey, you guys are having a good time up there in Silver Lakes by the lake and the golf course, you know, invite me over sometime. And then, you know, they thought that was kind of strange. You know, they get information about the truck and the motorcycle. Kelly writes down the license plates, and they come back as Jonathan Hearns. And then Jonathan sends this long, weird, rambling letter to Jason. Again, the gist of it has some kind of religious overtones, but the gist of it is, you know, please, you know, forgive me for you know, my inappropriate actions, you know, when Robert was still alive, and I feel terrible about it. Life is short, and you know, they're getting, you know, they're just getting this very strange vibe from Jonathan Hearn, and then with Sabrina acting so strange, and the two of them apparently hooking up. Now Meyer is really, really suspicious. And you combine this with Sabrina's comments earlier about, yeah, we like to party and have a good time, but denying that she had any infidelity in her marriage, and this is starting to look a lot like infidelity. So now we've got the beginnings of a potential love triangle. And if Sabrina was involved with Jonathan, perhaps they wanted Robert out of the picture.
Now, you talk about the DMV records that they look up shows that this Jonathan has got a Ford diesel pickup and a Yamaha motorbike. So from that, they can proceed, and they start looking at Jonathan's cell phone records.
Yeah.
And at this Kern County address, you talk about, well, tell us about the incredible amount of communications from April to October, and tell us a little bit about this, how they came about to be able to think that they could phone and the records not be traceable.
Sure. The information from the Bernatines gives police probable cause to subpoena phone records, Jonathan's phone records. And when you subpoena phone records, all you get is, you know, which number called which number and how long the phone call lasted and whether any media was transferred, whether a photo was sent or a video or whatever. And what police find is an enormous amount of communication between Jonathan Hearn and Sabrina Lamone in the months before the murder, now, up till about, I guess, April before the murder. Now, for somebody who claims that, you know, she has no infidelity, no problems in her marriage, you know, this was, I mean, we're talking hundreds, perhaps thousands of communications between them and multimedia exchanges. Again, you don't know what it is, but that suggests they're sending each other photos and videos. And then all of a sudden, Jonathan's communication to Sabrina's phones ends in April. And Jonathan now has thousands of communications with some other phone number, a new phone number. And police look up that number. It's like, well, who's he calling now? And, I mean, we're talking in April, May, June, July, August. The communications with this phone on the day of the murder, around the time of, you know, hours before the murder, hours after the murder. And then in the weeks after that, there's all these, what's this mysterious phone call, this mysterious phone? It's not, you know, listed to anybody. Well, that means it's one of those pay-as-you-go burner phones. All of a sudden in April, the April before the August murder, Jonathan starts communicating with somebody using a burner phone. It's starting to look like whoever he's communicating with, and they have their suspicions, it's somebody they were trying to hide from police.
Now, they have a warrant to wiretap Jonathan's cell phone. This is November 7th. So in that surveillance of those, what do they discover? And again, all of these things proceed to another further warrant, but tell us what they determined from that. I know they sort of have the gist of it, but what do they further have as evidence as a result?
Yeah, so all of these phone calls suggest communication between Jonathan and Sabrina before, during, and after the murder. This gets them enough to get a wiretap. Now, wiretap means, as everyone knows, you can listen to the actual phone calls. You don't just get a record, you can listen. And starting in November 2014, August, September, October, November, just a few months after the murder, police are able to listen in on what Jonathan and Sabrina are actually saying to each other. It's a major operation. It's very hard to do a wiretap because you have to listen and be ready to listen 24 hours a day. You never know when people are going to call. And now the investigation takes a very dramatic turn. They can actually listen to Sabrina and Jonathan Hearn talking to each other about the death of her husband. And these are tapes that were played in court and that I listened to. And what you have right off the bat are two people acting very, very suspiciously. People worried about what other people are saying, worried about how it might look if anybody ever found out they were communicating. And it turns out from these wiretaps, these are two people who are deeply, deeply, deeply in love with each other, that this was a relationship that began before the murder and has now flourished after the murder. And they talk on and on and on about their love for each other and how much they need each other. And a lot of it is intertwined with talk of religion and biblical passages and what God would think about their situation. It's where the title of the book, Better Off Dead, comes from. At one point, Sabrina says, you know, it's probably better that Robert died. if he ever found out about our affair or if we ever got divorced, it would just crush him. And, you know, the gist of it is maybe he is better off dead. And this is just stunning to police.
As a result of this wiretap, too, it looks like Jonathan, after she talked to Detective Meyer, she's on the phone to Jonathan telling him about what she had learned from Detective Myers or what Detective Myers had said. He suspects right along, right from the beginning, and it's in his dialogue that he may believe that he doesn't want to say too much because he thinks the phones may be tapped. Now, with that, very interesting, I never heard this term before, the detective says, well, why don't we tickle the wire? What does he mean by that, and how do they tickle the wire?
Well, even though Jonathan and Sabrina are acting suspiciously, even though they're expressing their love and making, you know, no secret of their relationship, they never admit that they murdered or conspired to murder Robert.
Right.
And at times they even, like you said, they raise suspicions that maybe someone's listening in on their phone. So, and then they'll make kind of cryptic, we'll talk about this later, you know, off the phone. But there's nothing damning, you know, slam dunk admissions in these things. Just a lot of smoke, but not a lot of fire. And so, yeah, there's a phrase called tickle the wire. And what happens is Meyer's listening to all this stuff. So he decides he's going to inject information into these people's lives that will affect the way they talk to each other. He's going to goose them a little bit. He's gonna poke and prod them a little bit. And so he starts telling Sabrina things that aren't true. Meyer calls Sabrina, and she's very friendly on the phone. Meyer's very friendly on the phone. He says, yeah, you know, I think we have a DNA sample. You know, I think we got it from a drop of sweat. You know, this is all BS, but he's trying to see what Sabrina's reaction will be. Because if there's a DNA sample, that means they could figure out who the killer was. So the killer might have sweated while he was shooting Robert. And Jonathan being a fireman, you know, his information might well be on file somewhere, or they can get it. So after Meyer tells Sabrina that we have this DNA sample, what does Sabrina do? She gets on the phone with Jonathan and relates everything immediately to him that the detective had just told her. So it only increases the suspicion that they're conspiring, or at least talking. They just look a lot more guilty. They're clearly in this whole enterprise together.
Interesting, too, at the same time that Jonathan, thinking he's clever, but yet still racked with guilt, it seems, but still thinking he's clever, because as part of his paramedic training, he's also taking arson investigation. And in part of that is included his basic criminal investigation. So he thinks he has a basic understanding, and it's just combined with his paranoia.
Yeah, you know, Jonathan, he grew up in a very religious household. He was homeschooled in a Christian school. His mother was his teacher all through his schooling. He very steeped in all things religion, and his conscience is really starting to get to him. Now, in the tapes, it's all about the affair. He doesn't say anything about murder, but his conscience about sleeping with the widow of this guy is really starting to get to him, and he's starting to unravel. At the same time, yes, he is a fireman. He's training to be an arson investigator. He has some information about DNA investigations. You know, he's no dummy, and he's trying to figure out, and in his conversations with Sabrina, you know, like, what does this mean, and what do they have, they start kind of strategizing about what she should and should not tell police.
And what is there, again, you talked about the DNA because the tickling the wire, they talk about the DNA, they also talk about the beginning of what they said was, oh, we think that this might not be ever solved. This looks like a dead end. And so that makes Jonathan suspicious. But what, as they put on the pressure, what seems to get to both of them as they proceed with this and tighten their grip on and trying to get to the actual truth?
Right. Well, a couple of things. First, Meyer brings Sabrina into Bakersfield for another in-person interview, and this causes a lot of concern between Sabrina and Jonathan. And again, they talk for hours about what she should say, what she shouldn't say, and yada, yada, yada. But the breaking point comes when, and keep in mind this is over a series of weeks, but Meyer just keeps ratcheting up the pressure. He keeps feeding new information. And parallel to all this, more security footage is being pulled. And Meyer, just on a lark, thinks, oh, what's halfway between Tehachapi and Jonathan Hearn's house? Well, it's this little truck stop in the middle of the desert. Let's see if anybody's stopped there. Well, sure enough, security footage sees a guy on a motorcycle that looks very much like Jonathan's motorcycle go into a little mini mart there to buy some Gatorade. The guy very suspiciously leaves his helmet on, but there's all this footage, and the timing works out perfectly, the exact amount of time, you know, that Jonathan could have ridden his motorcycle from the crime scene to this truck stop. It all matches up. And at the same time, they find out from another nearby business, they get more security footage. Again, they see a figure that looks like the limping guy on a motorcycle going back and forth. So, you know, it's all starting to look like Jonathan. And the breaking point, where the tickling becomes the strangling of the wire, is when Meyer shows some of the security footage from the truck stop of the guy on the motorcycle to Sabrina. He texts it to her. And then he says to her, yeah, we got this anonymous tip that we should be looking into somebody named John, J-O-N. Jonathan spells his name without the H. And, you know, do you know any Johns out there? And she's like, well, he worked with a guy named John Justice, and there might be another John, but she doesn't mention Jonathan Hearn. Now, she and Jonathan Hearn are on the phone, and they're going crazy, going absolutely crazy.
Now, how does it come that she gets arrested before we talk about, you know, we're just starting to get into the bizarre elements of this?
Well, you know, it reaches the point where, you know, she's lying through her teeth to Meyer. Of course she knows the John, you know. She's sleeping with him. He's playing with her kids. He's over at the house. They've got hundreds of hours of phone call. They have all this sort of conspiratorial talk between the two of them. She lied about the not having an affair. You know, it's really starting to look like, you know, that she's covering up something. And so, you know, at the same time, they have not interviewed Jonathan. They just only listened to him on the phone. It's gotten to the point where they think they have all they're going to get from the wiretap, so they arrest them both on the same day.
Now, surprise about what does Jonathan do? We talk about, again, this was incredible, this, I would say, unscrupulous attorney here, this Campbell, comes forward for Jonathan. So tell us how that case proceeds against Jonathan. Before we see the development that surprises a lot of people regarding Sabrina.
Yeah, so Jonathan hires a very good attorney named, you know, I've just forgot his first name, Campbell in Bakersfield. He's a top flight attorney. This is somebody who's a friend of a friend of the family's. He gets a really good defense attorney. And Jonathan, unbeknownst to the public, has been so racked with guilt and feels so terrible and feels that he has sinned so badly that he wants to confess to the murder right off the bat. And he wants to stand up in front of the judge and say, look, I shot him. I shot him. I was in love with Sabrina. And his attorney says, no, let's not do that just yet. Now, that's not unscrupulous. That's, you know, a lot of clients want to confess to things, or they will confess to more than what they really did, or whatever. It's up to the state to build a case against a defendant. And, you know, let's see what they have. Let's see what they really have on you before you go and start confessing to things. And all for all Campbell knows is that, you know, his client's nuts, you know. So he's like, well, let's just let things kind of run its course. And so in the meantime, his attorney is sort of investigating, and this is, you know, months now are passing after the arrests, and his attorney and their investigator go to Jonathan's house, and they're kind of poking around to see what he has, and what he has kind of locked up there is not good. They find a flash drive that has some photos that Jonathan had taken when he had swung by the murder scene earlier in kind of a reconnaissance mission. They eventually find other incriminating, evidence at the house that Jonathan's telling about. Now, there's attorney-client privilege, so, you know, if the lawyer just puts the evidence back, and this is stuff, keep in mind, Jonathan's house has been searched, but Jonathan knows where he's hiding this stuff, and you know, as long as the lawyer puts it back, he's under no ethical obligations to pass on incriminating information. In fact, he's under ethical obligations not to pass on incriminating information about his client. So, yeah, he's a little cagey about it, but it's starting to dawn on Jonathan's client that, yeah, he is guilty of sin. It's going to be really hard to avoid, at the very least, life without possibility of parole.
Now, at the same time or soon after, there's a surprise in regards to the arrest of Sabrina. Tell us what happens and why people are surprised. Tell us some of the details.
Well, Sabrina is arrested the same time that Jonathan is. They're both jails nearby. They're both supposed to have their arraignments on the same day. And, you know, Sabrina is interrogated. And I'm not answering your question, but she's interrogated by a number of different cops. I mean, really raked over the coals. And in two different stations and overnight, and she finally talks to Meyer again. And, you know, she kind of sort of reluctantly says, yeah, okay. She finally admits that she had this affair with him, with Jonathan. She continues to deny that she was involved in the murder. She says, yes, they were conspiratorial on the phone, but they were trying to cover up an affair. She was very embarrassed and thought it would look really bad if people knew about it. And, you know, finally she sort of reluctantly says, yeah, I guess maybe near the end I did sort of think Jonathan might have had something to do with it, but I didn't. I just refused to believe it. I loved him so much. He seemed so nice. And, it doesn't play super well with the cops. They present this information to the DA. The DA says, hold on to Jonathan, but let Sabrina go.
Now, you talk about what Sabrina does. We talk about the $300,000. You didn't mention that other settlement from the railroad itself, but she moves because there's bullying of her children, and she's harassed and talking.
Yeah, life becomes unbearable for Sabrina after she's released from jail. And, you know, again, this is a very small, isolated town, and one school. Everyone knows everybody, but she just can't take it anymore. She's pursuing claims against the railroad. That's not really going anywhere. And then she finally moves to Camarillo near the coast, outside of Los Angeles.
Now, meanwhile, you talk about someone from Robert's family communicating with Jonathan via letter in prison.
Yeah.
What do they ask him, and what do they basically get him to start thinking about seriously?
Well, Jonathan has a lot of time to think. And, you know, one of the things that Jonathan knew about Sabrina, and we haven't talked about it yet, but one of the reasons Sabrina was so unhappy in her marriage to Robert, is one of the big secrets of Silver Lakes, is that she and Robert used to be swingers, old-fashioned Playboy Channel swingers. And they would wife swap with a spouse swap with another couple. And, you know, at first, Sabrina really kind of liked it. Sabrina was a big drinker, and they would party. And, you know, but after a while, she got tired of it. But Robert didn't. And she kept feeling like he was pressuring her into this lifestyle. And she felt dehumanized and objectified. But Robert didn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He just wanted to go, you know, play on his boat. And it's one of the reasons why Sabrina was so attracted to Jonathan. He was this, you know, Boy Scout. He was this very religious young man. He was, you know, squeaky clean. Nothing bad about him at all. But Jonathan knew this about her past life. And one of Robert's sisters starts sending letters to Jonathan in jail. And she referred to it as poking the bear. And what happened after Jonathan was arrested and Sabrina was released is that Sabrina starts seeing one of her old swinger pals again, this guy who used to be in this swinger circle with them.
Right.
You know, she just dropped Jonathan like a bad habit. And if they did, you know, murder Robert in a conspiracy, well, Jonathan's taken the fall, and Sabrina's off swinging again. So one of Robert's sisters happens to pass on that, oh, yeah, Sabrina's seen so-and-so again, you know. You know, how much this played into Jonathan's psyche, we'll never know, but it probably played a little bit of a role, and Jonathan's now taking kind of a whole new look at Sabrina Lamone.
And he's also taken a whole new look at the idea of confession. And you talk about some of the players involved in this as well. If I'm correct, that Campbell shared something with his client that helped him in this case. They helped each other in this case because of that background. Tell us about that.
Well, Campbell, his lawyer, like Jonathan, had been homeschooled, and his lawyer was very religious. They would pray together, pray for each other. And so his lawyer understood sort of the desire, the deep, genuine desire by Jonathan to obtain grace and forgiveness. Yet at the same time, under the law, you're guilty and, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So, you know, these sort of religious feelings about having to confess and come clean with God conflicts with the idea that you're innocent until proven guilty. You just shut up until, you know, they make you go to prison. So, you know, the lawyer really understands what's going through Jonathan's head right now and this conflict between the sort of spiritual and worldly issues. The lawyer also gets wind that Robert's family, weirdly, is not that as upset with Jonathan as they are with Sabrina. Remember, Sabrina's off. She's in Camarillo, this beautiful little coastal community, playing with her friends, you know, totally free as a bird. They think that Sabrina put Jonathan up to this, and they kind of let it slip that, look, you know, we're not as mad at you, Jonathan, as we are at Sabrina. So, you know, it wouldn't be bad for us if you cut a deal as long as Sabrina got punished.
Mm-hmm. So Campbell agrees and sets up to negotiate a deal because there wasn't much, you know, he was charged for conspiracy, murder, some very heavy charges. So he had to agree to something very, very important, which is a complete, full, truthful confession. And then what was the deal he was offered for this?
He was given a good deal. the DA really wanted to get Sabrina. The family, Robert's family, really wanted to get Sabrina. So much so that they were willing to make what would later be called the deal with the devil, and that was Jonathan. And they were going to offer him, and I can't remember if it was 20 or 25 years.
25,
thank you. 25 years in prison, and before he can make parole, in exchange for, it's like a voluntary manslaughter, not even a murder, plea, as long as he said everything he knew. Now, keep in mind, Campbell knows that there's all this evidence still at Jonathan's house. Jonathan lives in this pigsty of a house, and he's got all this stuff socked away that the police don't know about. They searched the house, but they didn't find it. You know, keep in mind, cops don't have the gun. They don't have anything really linking Jonathan, you know, physically to the murder, except for his suspicious behavior. So, you know, Campbell's going to say, look, we will tell you where all this stuff is so that you can solve this case once and for all. Plus, Jonathan will agree to testify against Sabrina and say that she was just as much a part of all this as he was, put him up to it, that she wanted Robert dead just as much. And in exchange, we will take 25 years in prison. Now, that's a long time, but Jonathan's in his 20s, early 20s.
Hmm.
He will have a lot of life left after he gets out. He'll be a man of his, in his 50s if he takes this deal. And the lawyer talks to Jonathan, and Jonathan agrees.
And you talk about that when they speak to him, he really does talk. They say he talks and talks and talks, and he also tells them about something that there later results in other charges about another attempt at murder. Tell us a little bit about
Jonathan's
that.
Jonathan's a man who finally can get all this off his chest. And he also tells them that this wasn't the first time they attempted to kill Robert. They were going to poison him by lacing his Nilla wafer pudding, which was his favorite dessert, with this cyanide trioxide. Jonathan is able, he was going to make the pudding, and then Sabrina was going to give the pudding to Robert, and last minute they call off the idea. But Jonathan's able to point them to a lot of evidence, the vial of the poison, the silencer that was used in the killing, remember that bulky clothing that the person was wearing on the security video, he shows
right.
Where that is, you know, all kinds of stuff.
He also shows him the silencer for the weapon.
Yeah, it's a silencer he made himself. He tells him where to find that.
You talk about the dramatic opening of the trial now, September 11th, 2017, and you talk about the DA Smith talking about Robert being removed as husband to be replaced as father to their two children. This was their plan and their purpose. And her attorney is Richard Terry. And condition of this deal is that he testifies against at trial. Tell us how this proceeds, and as you do, some of the more interesting moments during this trial.
Sure. What's interesting is that even though Sabrina stood to get millions of dollars, that was all theoretical, you know, as if she successfully sued the railroad. The motive here was never really alleged to be money, primarily. It was just to get Robert out of the way, to be replaced by the nicer, cleaner, more religious Jonathan Hearn. Jonathan would then become the father to the children, and they would live happily ever after up there in the desert. And so the trial faced, you know, this dramatic kind of showdown between these former lovers who were so close, and Jonathan, before that, Kelly Bernatine takes the stand, Jason Bernatine takes the stand, you know, her best friends sat there in court and said, you know, we think you're a killer. It was heartbreaking. And then Jonathan takes the stand over several days of testimony and goes over in excruciating detail how they had this affair before the murder, how they had the affair after the murder, and how they plotted to kill Robert. And I think the most chilling day of the trial was when Jonathan talks about how he went to the railroad shop and he had the gun with the silencer. It was in a backpack, and he was wearing an old man's mask. And he walks up to Robert, and but right before that, Jonathan had to get his courage up, and he actually prayed to God for strength to kill this man. And he walks into the garage. He's wearing this mask. He's got the gun in a backpack, and it was kind of down at his side, and the gun either misfired or he fired it too soon, and that sort of explains why the bullet went up, because the gun was down low and it fired through the backpack and puts down Robert, and he says, I thought I heard a noise from Robert, so he goes back and delivers a coup de grace shot to Robert just to make sure he dies, and flees the scene. And you know, all along he says, you know, Sabrina knew about every single aspect of this.
What was Sabrina's reaction? I know you talk about that she was, certainly not flamboyant at trial before this, but what was her reaction to that testimony from Jonathan?
Yeah, she was, now keep in mind, Jonathan was an odd duck, and he was weirdly robotic on the witness stand, and he had intellectualized a lot of this. And Sabrina, you know, did not react emotionally very much. I never saw her cry. I never, you know, she would shake her head. She would roll her eyes. But she didn't, you know, even hearing this just horrible testimony, it just never seemed to elicit much of an emotional reaction from her. And the jury noted that.
What was the key point in Jonathan's testimony, sort of the death punch, we'll say, or death strike that he gave in his testimony?
I think it was the cumulative effect, but it was really talking about why they wanted Robert dead, and just how cold it was, and just how they had so rationalized and justified everything by saying he would be better off dead. You know, it's probably better for Robert that he's out of the way. You know, he'd be so upset if we ran off together. It's probably better even for him that he would be dead. And that was another point that the jurors clung to.
It's rare, but defendants usually don't testify. They get advice from their attorney. Did Sabrina testify?
She did, and you saw why defendants don't usually testify. She was terrible on the stand. She was emotionless. She couldn't answer questions, just simple questions. She kept saying, well, it's kind of hard to explain. It's kind of hard to explain. It's like, well, if there was ever a time to explain, now is it. You know, she was facing not 25 years maximum, but 25 years to life. She made a very bad impression on the witness stand. She was not very emotional. She couldn't really explain why she constantly lied to police. She kept saying, well, it just would have looked really bad if people knew about our affair. Well, people did know about their affair, and besides, half their friends were swingers, so, you know, what would they care? She just made a very, very bad impression on the witness stand.
Do you think Richard Terry had much choice with this, though, given the overwhelming evidence now that Jonathan was going to testify and all of the... Again, you say circumstantial, but a mountain of circumstantial evidence and inference and like common sense people would no doubt want to convict her. Is that why he put her on?
I do think, well, there's two issues. I do think he had a choice. Keep in mind, in California, as in other states, it's ultimately up to the defendant whether to testify. It's not up to the lawyer.
Certainly.
But I do think he had a choice, and I think he made the wrong one. It was a circumstantial case. never in hundreds of hours of wiretaps did she ever admit to killing her husband or conspiring to kill him or even knowing that Jonathan killed him. It looked bad. It looked bad. It looked terrible. But that's the basis of a reasonable doubt case. You know, didn't have the slam dunk. That's the reason why they let her go to begin with. All they really had was Jonathan on the witness stand trying to save his ass, implicating her. And if the jury did not believe him, and like I said, he was strangely detached in his testimony. He was a weird guy. And if they did not believe him, then they could have found sufficient reasonable doubt. So that was number one. Number two, and just some breaking news today, she has appealed her case, seeking a new trial, claiming that her counsel, Terry, was ineffective counsel.
Of course.
And alleging that he did not properly prepare her for her testimony. And that's why she couldn't answer simple questions, because she hadn't been prepared. She even alleged that on the weekend before her testimony, rather than being prepared by Terry, Terry went off to a jazz festival. So she's blaming her attorney for not properly preparing her. But in the end, it's her decision, and she might have said something at the time. I think, you know, it's hard to say. It was not the strongest case that I've ever seen. Anyone who's ever watched the OJ trial would know that, you know, you never know what a jury's going to do. Probably was not a good idea to put her on the stand.
It's probably not a good idea if you want to at least have a chance at appeal as well. Like you say, a lot of people do the ineffective counsel idea, but there also was the idea that certainly Jonathan had a motive to be able to want to testify with the lessened sentence. So that sometimes is an issue that at least they try to make an issue in appeal.
Exactly. And, you know, it was more of a 50-50 case, I would say, if she did not testify, but I think it leaned more kind of 70-30 when she did. And I just don't think it helped that she testified. You know, I understand that they had a lot of explaining to do, but her explanations didn't really help.
You talk about the cameras were allowed in the courtroom despite objections from Terry. But you also say that in the trial, it seemed that through testimony that the reputation and sort of the humanity, not the sort of, the humanity, the goodness of Robert was expressed in that trial, especially by, tell us about that.
Yeah, Robert was not a perfect man, and none of us are. And it was interesting that it was the prosecution that did not want to get into all the swinger stuff, and which could have easily been used as a motive, you know, that she was angry over the swinging. That's why she wanted to kill. It was brought up by the defense, which I found also kind of strange. But his, you know, he was a flawed man. He was, you know, as I researched his background, he came from his family, his parents were divorced. He came from a kind of a tougher life. And, you know, you can understand why he didn't want to confront certain issues and why he didn't want to party and kind of just always focus on the fun and the good and not dwell on the bad, because he had had so much bad and so much hard times in his life. And I think a lot of that came through but there was a lot of humanity on all sides. And I think that's what, you know, going back to your first question, what drew me to the case is that, you know, I'm not a family member of the victim, so it's easy for me to say, but, you know, you can find a lot of humanity in everybody here. And Jonathan certainly was a very tragic figure near the end. He really wrestled with his faith. He really wrestled with some demons. And through much of the trial, it was a toss-up to me whether Sabrina was even guilty, you know, whether she was just so dumb that she went along with this thing and got hoodwinked by the charming Jonathan, or whether she was an actual conspirator. And then you think of their children, you know, or their father's dead and their mother's in prison for the rest of her life, and all these awful secrets are bared for the world to see, and you can't help but kind of feel badly for everybody. And it's like, you know, there are so many other ways to solve these problems without having to resort to a gun.
One of the things that we didn't talk about was very interesting is that the very, very religious people that these were, these Christians, and also that there had been something that Jonathan had been taught and his other siblings about a story from the Bible that other people were familiar. I don't know if it was Campbell or one of the detectives was in this story was familiar with this biblical story of Bathsheba and David. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so David and Bathsheba, and maybe, you know, we all learned it in Sunday school, but David, of course, king and commander of the troops, he saw Bathsheba, this beautiful woman, bathing or anointing herself on the roof, and one day and fell in love with, just in lust with Bathsheba. And David arranged to have Bathsheba's husband sent off to the front to be killed so that David could have Bathsheba for himself. And, you know, much of the Psalms are David's laments for what he had done and trying to get right with God. And at one point on the wiretaps, a couple points on the wiretaps, Jonathan says to Sabrina, you know, we're very much like David and Bathsheba. And he even directs her to read some of the Psalms and coming clean with God. And you know, it's a chilling parallel. And one of the cops who was listening in on the wiretap had been a religious scholar in college and immediately made the connection. It's like, it's almost an admission.
And the idea, too, that Bathsheba, one of the interesting parts of this was, did Bathsheba know that David had killed her husband, because they got together and had children afterwards?
Right.
So did she know? And that was central to this, too.
Yeah. I mean, most biblical scholars will tell you, no, Bathsheba didn't know. And that's the difference, that Sabrina was no Bathsheba.
Yeah. We talked about her in prison. What was her sentence? You mentioned that there was an appeal just today.
Yeah, she
recently
hasn't actually been sentenced because just today, I think, her new attorney filed for a new trial claiming ineffective counsel. So sentencing has been put on hold. She would theoretically get 25 to life under the statute, which means that Sabrina would theoretically get more time in prison than Jonathan, who actually pulled the trigger.
Still, there is eligibility for parole possible with even with the sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, there is, but it's California conspiracy to commit. It's 25 minimum, so she would be looking at a long time. She's 10 years older than Jonathan, so
right.
You know, she may never come out of prison.
Yeah, fascinating. And update on Jonathan?
Jonathan is, last I heard, he's teaching Bible study in prison. He's still wrestling with his conscience and his faith. At his sentencing, it was a formality because he'd already agreed to it, but it was a difficult thing to watch, the remorse. And he was no longer Mr. Robotic. He is a guy, I think, really trying to figure out what went wrong in his brain. You know, why did he do this? I don't think he can even answer that question himself.
Wow, incredible. I want to thank you very much, Michael, for coming on and talking about Better Off Dead, a sordid true story of sex, sin, and murder. It's been fascinating. For those that might want to look at other material that you have done, you have a website, Facebook. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you can go on michaelfleeman.com, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, fleeman.com. If you go on Amazon and punch in my name, all my books come up. Go on Facebook. It's called True Crime Page on Facebook. I love to hear from people, and I will definitely respond to you. I send over links and updates and about what I'm doing. And you can go on the publisher's website, Wild Blue Press, wildbluepress.com, and look for my name under the authors, and I have a page there, and you can list comments. But if you want to get in touch with me, get on Facebook or go on my website, michaelfleeman.com, and there's a contact me button, and I promise I'll email you back.
Sounds great. Thank you again, Michael Fleeman, for coming on and talking about Better Off Dead. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.